It's to the best of our knowledge from PRI. Today, invisible workers. I'm Ann Strainchamps, and here's a story. Every day, millions of us shop online. We fill our virtual shopping carts, then we hit send. It feels seamless, automated, kind of like a digital assembly line. But you know, there are real human beings filling those orders.
Yeah, I was basically, you know, a robot piece in this assembly line, and my only job was to pick items as quickly and as efficiently as possible.
Meet Mac McClelland. She's a journalist who's reported from all over the world, and for a recent assignment, she went undercover to work at an online retail warehouse right here in the U.S.
The warehouse was absolutely enormous, several floors, and it's just rows and rows and rows and rows of stuff. There's all manner of toys, sex toys, actually, lots of, which I was surprised to see, groceries. There was a battery-operated flour sifter. Anything you could possibly think of exists in this warehouse.
So there she was, one of 4,000 temporary workers brought on to help out with the early Christmas rush, and all of them working in this cavernous space.
And it was absolutely silent, just no noise, even though there were thousands upon thousands of people working, like silent little worker bees. You can have conversations where you're sort of like running past each other, you know, sort of like a high-speed drive-by conversation where you're just like, hey, how's it going? Hey, I'm fine.
There isn't time to talk because everyone's always on their feet, running back and forth, grabbing items to ship. Max says she ran about 12 miles a day. That's like a half marathon every day. And just like a marathon, everyone's being timed.
You have a little scanner that tells you how many seconds you have to make each order fulfillment. So it'll say, like, it's in this section of the warehouse, on this shelf, this row, this level, this color code. And you have 15 seconds to get to that spot and get the Barbie doll. So you just hustle. And then as soon as you scan the barcode with your little handheld scanner, it gives you the next thing. And it will say, again, you have 18 seconds to get to this space in the warehouse. And as you're walking, it will count down the time, like 17, 16, 15. So you just run back and forth doing your job, and then you leave.
Just think about that for a second. All that running, climbing, crouching, bending for 8 hours a day, every day. It hurts.
By the end of the day, I had screaming pains in my knees, my hips. You know, I was 31 years old. I'd never felt my knees or my hips in my life. Because again, a lot of the items are on floor level or below waist or chest level. So hundreds of times per day, you have to drop to the floor and stand back up again and drop to the floor and stand back up again. And by the last day, I was in so much pain from doing that so often that if I had items that were on the floor that were near where I already was, instead of stand up and then, you know, crouch back down, I would crawl to the next shelf over.
So this sucks, right? But if you're like me, you're thinking, well, what does it have to do with me? But here's the thing. Max says it's this physical cost that keeps the prices low for all of us. That's why we shop there.
We have this expectation now that our items are going to be super cheap and they're going to ship for free. And, you know, I was buying stuff on Amazon and I was never thinking, how does this company post these revenues, sell everything at a discount and ship everything for free? Like, how does that even work? So, I mean, you have to squeeze it out of the laborers who are doing it. Like, of course, it's costing somebody.
Mac's warehouse story is just one example, but there are millions of invisible workers out there who we never hear about. So in this hour, we're taking time to recognize some of the people who work in the shadows. For instance, maybe you started the day with a bowl of cereal, maybe some fresh strawberries or blueberries on top. Well, who do you think picked those berries?
So the pickers who I got to know well were indigenous Mexicans, native Mexicans from southern Mexico, who left their own farms to come here to work on our farms, picking strawberries, blueberries, raspberries, and apples.
Seth Holmes is a medical anthropologist who spent 2 years following migrant Mexican farm laborers all along the West Coast, in Washington State and Central California. And when I say following, he wasn't just watching from the sidelines. He was actually out in the fields picking berries alongside the workers.
The work was very difficult. We often started before sunrise or right around sunrise in the morning, and the picking was by contract, meaning that you're paid per pound, you're not paid per hour. So we were paid 14 cents per pound of strawberries that we picked, and in order to meet the minimum, you would have to pick 50 pounds of de-leafed, appropriately ripe strawberries every hour, which is really difficult.
Well, wait, 50 pounds an hour.
50 pounds an hour. In order to pick that quickly, 50 pounds of berries every hour, everyone's kneeling down all the way on their knees on the ground, picking with both hands at once, popping off the tops of the strawberries and trying to get as many as they can into their buckets, and then rushing to the white teenagers who are in charge of weighing the buckets of berries on the picker's card in order to keep track of how much they've picked that day.
Was it hard for you to keep up?
As a matter of fact, I never kept up. So I couldn't keep up even after 2 full summers and the year in between working alongside the farm workers.
Now, you're a doctor and you were doing this work as a medical anthropologist. So I'm assuming, you know, you're very intensely aware of the physical toll and the health costs of doing work like this. What did you see?
The most common issues that I saw were hip pain and hip injuries, knee pain and knee injuries, ankle pain, ankle injuries, back pain, back injuries. At times, you would see signs of pesticide poisoning or even malformations when people gave birth that were likely related to pesticides.
There's a moment you write about in the book that really stuck with me. It's, I think, your second day picking berries, and you see this long tractor spraying stuff into the field around you, and eventually you found out it was insecticide. And how did you respond, and what did the people who were working in that field with you, how did they respond?
In this particular incident, I remember watching the tractor spraying something in the field, asking one of the farm managers what it was. He said, "Dangerous insecticides," and shook his head at me. And I sort of was thinking through, you know, oh gosh, I've heard of this before. I wonder what this is doing to our lungs or our eyes or anything else. Later on, I watched a video about the health effects of pesticides with some of the farm workers who I lived in the labor camp near and picked next to. And I asked the farm workers I was with what they thought about the video. And one of them said, "Well, pesticides affect only white Americans because your bodies are delicate and weak." And then in further conversation, they explained that the native Mexicans were tough and that their bodies hold out. And when they looked at the different hierarchies on the farm, the kinds of jobs the white people usually had and the kinds of jobs the native Mexicans usually had, that in a certain way served as evidence of who was delicate and weak and who was strong enough to do the hard work.
So, you know, there are plenty of people who would say that at the end of the day, this is still a matter of choice. You know, if workers like these don't like the work, they can always work somewhere else or go back to their home country. So let's talk about one particular worker, you know, and why he or she makes the choice to come here and do this kind of work.
Sure. The first person who comes to mind is Joaquin, who I crossed the border with from his hometown, a native village in southern Mexico in Oaxaca. We took a bus to the border of Mexico and the United States, hiked across the border for 19 hours in the middle of the night.
Wait, you made an illegal border crossing yourself?
Correct. I crossed with roughly 10 native Mexican farm workers who were coming from Mexico to work on strawberry farms up in California and Washington.
Wow. That must have been an intense trip.
It was very intense. It was harrowing and very scary, and I don't think I would do it again. And part of the reason I brought this story up is that none of the people who were crossing, including Joaquin, who I was crossing with, experienced this as a choice. They all explained that crossing the border was the only option left for them, that they didn't have a choice in crossing.
Why not?
So roughly 22 years ago, the North American Free Trade Agreement was signed. And one of the effects of the North American Free Trade Agreement was cheap U.S. corn has flooded Mexican markets, making it impossible for the native people who developed corn in the first place and have been growing multiple kinds and multiple colors of corn to continue functioning in that way.
So they can't make a living doing the subsistence farming they've done for generations?
Exactly. They can't make a living growing the corn or beans anymore that they've grown for generations. Instead, they have to come up to the United States to work as laborers on our farms.
So when you talked with Joaquin about why he was making this trip and why he keeps coming back, what did he say?
He and other people explained that there's no work for them in their home village. There's no way for them to survive there. And the only way for them and their family to survive is for them to migrate somewhere else to work and send back money. And some of them explained that the further away they migrated, the more time they could spend back home and the more money they could send back home for their family to survive. So if they went to a nearby town, for example, Oaxaca City, they might be able to sell some crafts that they had made, but they wouldn't make very much money doing that. If they migrated further north to Baja California, they could work on a farm, but they wouldn't make as much money. And if they crossed the border, which for many people is a deadly border, and worked in the United States, then ironically, they and their family were more likely to be able to survive.
Is there another story you could also tell us, just to continue to kind of paint a picture of who's behind our morning strawberries? There's one I remember you wrote about, Crescencio.
Sure. Crescencio is a man also from the same home village, also a native Mexican, who came to the United States in a similar way. He felt forced to come to the U.S. with his wife and oldest son in order for them to support themselves and their relatives back home. Oftentimes when he was working, he would experience what other people would experience of being called names. For example, sometimes the managers on different farms will call the native Mexicans things like Indio Estupido, which means stupid Indian. Mm. Sometimes they would be called burro, which means donkey, or perro, which means dog. And oftentimes when he was called these names, he would get these headaches in the center of his head that were excruciating to him, that would make it hard for him to work. And he was very worried that with these headaches, he might be prone to getting upset with his wife and kids at home or with the other workers on the farm. And he was doing everything he could to seek treatment from traditional healers as well as the migrant physicians in migrant clinics to get rid of these headaches.
You know, Seth, the story you're telling presents, that's a pretty damning indictment of us as consumers. A lot of us are buying fresh berries and fruit and vegetables in order to live a healthy lifestyle. But it sounds like our health is coming at the cost of many migrant workers' sickness. Who do you blame here? You know, the farm owners for the way they're treating the workers, us consumers for continuing to buy strawberries and berries thoughtlessly?
I blame all of us in many ways. I think we're all in the same boat. We all share in responsibility for making this system change. I completely agree with you. I think that's the main point that I'm trying to get across in the book, is that the health that many of us, the consumers, the eaters, experience from fresh fruit and vegetables comes at a price of other families, brothers and sisters, parents and kids, becoming sick, having injuries, having pesticide poisoning, risking their lives to cross borders in order to provide us with that fruit and those vegetables. So I think on one level, we as eaters need to do our best to choose the berries from farms that are treating their workers well, which does not always mean local farms, and it doesn't always mean small farms, and it doesn't always mean organic farms. There have been several sociologists and other researchers who have shown us through their research that farms of all different sizes can treat their workers well and can treat their workers poorly.
You know what I don't understand is I think a lot of consumers do care about the poor and the disenfranchised. Americans generally want to live in an equitable society. So why are migrant workers invisible in this way? I mean, it's not as though we don't know that migrant workers pick our fruit and vegetables.
What I found in my research, in interviews and in living with the farm workers, was in a certain way that what's going on is what we might call structural racism. So there's a sociologist who passed away a few years ago. His name is Pierre Bourdieu. He's French. And he writes about the ways in which these forms of structural hierarchy or structural racism, where certain ethnic groups have certain jobs and others don't, are reinforced by the frameworks or the narratives or the symbols that we use to make sense of things. So, for example, when someone says that Mexicans should be picking strawberries because they're lower to the ground, quote unquote, that reinforces this structure of hierarchy where Mexicans are more likely to have those jobs, where people don't question it, where when they're on strike, they're not taken as seriously and they're not offered other kinds of jobs. So there's this reinforcement by through narrative or framework of the structures in which we live that actually make many of us sick or are related to our bodies becoming injured.
Hmm. It's depressing because, I mean, I don't know how old you are, but, you know, a lot of us have been talking about the treatment of migrant farm workers for decades. I mean, how can things not be better?
You're right. It is depressing. At the same time, if we think about these narratives, for example, the bodies of Mexicans belong picking strawberries, reinforcing the structures that we live in, there's a way in which changing those narratives or changing those structures also reinforces a change.
Seth Holmes' book about the 2 years he spent following migrant farm workers is called Fresh Fruit, Broken Bodies. We're going to take a quick break, but coming up, the invisible army of workers who put in long hours, make their bosses' lives easier, and almost never get paid, and who sometimes compete for the privilege.
We've seen intern auctions, fundraisers that auction off an internship for the donor's child to work in a glamour industry.
Yep. It's to the best of our knowledge. From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. We're talking about and meeting invisible workers in this hour. And here's someone you might have come across, especially if you work in an office, the intern. In a lot of industries, unpaid internships are the only way to get a foot in the door. But recently, serious questions have come up about the ethics and even the legality of hiring interns. For instance, back in 2009, Eric Glad was an unpaid intern on the set of the film Black Swan. He did the kind of stuff that was pretty standard for an accounting clerk, fetching signatures, circulating documents, processing receipts. But as time passed, Eric started feeling uncomfortable with the work, not because it was demeaning, but because he was worried it was illegal, that it violated the Labor Department's standards for unpaid internships. And so he did the unthinkable. He took his employer, Fox Searchlight, to court. Eric sat down with producer Raymond Tungekar to explain why.
I had interviewed for a job, and they were looking for a person with editing skills, familiar with certain software, who had an impressive showreel, which I provided and came in for the interview to discuss what kind of terms the job might be. And she explained it was going to be an unpaid internship because they'd never budgeted for hiring another person. At this point, I was familiar enough with the law, and I flat out told the interviewer, I think you've just suggested an illegal workplace arrangement that violates the Fair Labor Standards Act. I think you have to pay the minimum wage for this. And she rather dismissively waved her hand in the direction of the rest of the building and just sort of said, oh, I can find 10 people walking these halls that would be happy to do this for free. So I'm not even going to ask the producer for more money. That's just it. And at that point, that was the straw that broke the camel's back for me. I realized somebody had to do something.
I can only imagine how dispiriting that was, because what she said, the fact that there were 10 other people waiting to get that same job, I mean, she was probably right.
Oh, yeah. The structural conditions that make this possible are really clear, and they were clear to me. I mean, I knew she was right, too. What was so frustrating was simply that, I don't know, that things have gotten so bad that these hard-won labor standards are just dismissively shrugged off. I mean, that's what's really frustrating. What was really frustrating was how, basically how lonely it felt. Even friends of mine who sympathized with me in principle advised me against doing anything about it, you know, because the advice is, well, that's career suicide. But I mean, such is the history of the labor movement, and I'm certainly not suggesting that my plight was anywhere near as dire as it is for many others.
But yet, I mean, you were able to work in an industry that you presumably loved. And yeah, you know, with any job, there are going to be aspects of it that you don't like. But I guess that's just the way it works for a lot of industries. You know, if you don't like it, then you just go work someplace else.
Yeah, that's a really pernicious attitude I've confronted, which is, well, if you don't like it, go work somewhere else. Or this idea that you will hear from people who are doing unpaid internships when they're made aware of the fact that it's violating the law, the suggestion being, oh, the minimum wage law, that's not for us. Like, we're aspiring to work in a sexy, exciting industry, Hollywood, or music, or journalism, or whatever it might be. Whereas, oh, the minimum wage law, that's for people working at McDonald's and Burger King. That's not our concern. And I think that's an incredible danger, but it speaks to a lot of the divide in America today.
You know, it's funny you mention that, because when I actually first heard about this case, I either was an unpaid intern or I had just completed one. And I just remember thinking that exact thing. Like, I get to do something I love. I'm in a privileged position, so I shouldn't have to fight for a minimum wage.
Yeah, and taking advantage of that attitude is one of the ways that we've seen sort of the middle-class jobs get carved out of our economy. You know, to give another example, I would, you know, before Black Swan started shooting, when it was in pre-production and there were rehearsals, one of the unpaid interns was picking up the performers at their hotel or apartment and driving them to the rehearsal space. Now, for that unpaid intern, you know, a young adult who said, oh, wow, I pick up a celebrity every day, we chat in the car, and I go to the thing, and I'm impressing my bosses, this is awesome. Well, as production came closer, some of the Teamsters Union found out that they had basically had one of their jobs stolen from them, because driving belongs to the Teamsters. And as soon as the Teamsters found out that they were using an unpaid intern to do this driving, a Teamster began doing it. Somebody who needs to put food on the table for his family had his job returned to him. The fact that the unpaid intern looked at it as a glamour position was disregarding the fact that it was taking out of the labor market a good union wage earning job from somebody who deserves to have it.
So for you, I mean, this isn't just a matter of wage theft for interns. This is a systemic problem that involves the disintegration of workers' rights.
Oh, absolutely. I think this creation of a sort of ghost economy of unpaid labor is, at its core, represents a dismissal and a disregard for basic labor principles. People lost their lives establishing these principles and getting them codified into law. And I think it's really, really dangerous when people who can afford to work for free disregard these basic issues. I think it affects everybody.
You know, your lawsuit kicked off a series of similar ones by former unpaid interns. Are we nearing the end of the unpaid internship?
Well, I certainly do hope so. Or at a minimum, that unpaid internships start complying to the fullest extent of what the law says they need to look like. Now, I happen to think, having looked at this for a long time, that it's very difficult to implement a program that properly respects everybody's labor rights and follows the law, and it'd be better if they simply paid everybody. And the fact of the matter is, if you don't pay people, you're still creating a class barrier that people who can't afford it are basically excluded from doing it altogether. The young man who sued Warner Music Group, he spent part of his unpaid internship living in a homeless shelter. He's the kind of exception that proves the rule that for most people who can't afford to do it, they don't do it. You know, every once in a while, one person may come forward and roll the dice in a way like he did. But eventually he found he was just being exploited as well, and he sued Warner Music Group.
It seems to play into this whole narrative of being able to pick yourself up by your bootstraps. And, you know, there are stories of businessmen starting at the bottom or in the mailroom, and by virtue of their hard work, they're able to work their way to the top. I mean, do internships actually, do they demonstrate that?
Well, both they illustrate how romantic that notion is. But, I mean, it's interesting, the detail, right? He started in the mailroom and worked his way to the top. Well, that mailroom job was paid. There's a difference between being able to actually support yourself at a low salary, but still be able to support yourself and take care of your basic essentials and work your way up, versus this strange sort of tryout period where you have to, by definition, find the support somewhere else. It's a different argument altogether. But I think it goes to the you're right. It sort of plugs into that narrative without being very well examined.
So what do you tell someone who's considering taking on an unpaid internship?
Well, I'm not asserting that it's the responsibility of everyone out there to take a stand. You know, I made that decision. It was a personal decision. And I've heard from people who've been contemplating it and decided not to sue. And I understand that entirely. But I would suggest that anyone in that position both do what they can to improve conditions where they are, or to get involved with grassroots groups and find ways to agitate for change without necessarily associating your name with it. You know, you can get a message out there without necessarily risking your reputation if you feel that your reputation would be at risk.
Eric Glatt sued Fox Searchlight in 2011 over the terms of his unpaid internship, and he won. These days, he's an advocate for others. Raymond Tungekar talked with him. Now, where's that intern with my coffee? Just kidding. We now move on to perhaps the largest group of invisible workers, millions and millions of unpaid laborers who toil away every day supporting some of the biggest companies in the world. I'm talking about you. I mean, think about it. You pump your own gas at the service station, check out and bag your own groceries at the self-checkout line, book your own flights online, and bus your own table at the coffee shop. All things other people used to do for you. Craig Lambert calls this shadow work, and he says it's turning us all into middle-class serfs. Steve Paulson caught up with him.
Craig, you've written a whole book on these unseen jobs that we take on every day, but for the most part, these are just small chores or minor inconveniences. Why do you think we need to talk about this kind of work?
Well, these are jobs that very often were someone else's job in the past. And we often aren't aware that we're doing them, kind of sleepwalking through the day. We don't know we're doing shadow work, even while we're bagging our own groceries or pumping our own gas or becoming our own travel agents. We go into the airports and we check in with a kiosk instead of a human being, and there's a lot of time that gets absorbed by shadow work, and we don't notice that leisure time or free time slipping away.
So you're talking about self-service jobs. I mean, essentially jobs that used to be done by other people that were paid to do this, and now we do it ourselves.
That's right. Self-serve is sort of the watchword now. We've entered a self-serve economy in a lot of ways. And self-service very often becomes a synonym for no service. One thing that happens when you are your own, it's your job to do these things, is that people get edited out of the transaction. And you're dealing with kiosks instead of people.
And yet I'm guessing that a lot of people would see this as progress. I mean, in some ways, we're saving time and money by pumping our own gas or booking our own flights. And usually, if you really want someone else to do these things, you have that choice. You can find someone to do it. So I guess the question is, you know, what's wrong with giving people the option of doing these tasks on their own?
Well, indeed. You're quite right, Steve, that there are many cases when people choose to do shadow work. They will feel, for example, that they can get out of the gas station faster if they handle the transaction themselves. One example of self-serve is in restaurants when we go to a salad bar. Very often now, the customer is the person that has the job of making the salad, and there's nothing wrong with that. In fact, it gives you more autonomy. You get to control exactly how much you put in the terms of those cherry tomatoes or the romaine lettuce and how much dressing you put on. But on the other hand, you might have preferred to spend that time sitting at the table with your family or your friends chatting and have someone else make the salad for you.
But I suppose there's another way of looking at this, that maybe a lot of these kinds of jobs that were kind of service jobs that, you know, people used to do now that are getting phased out, and maybe those aren't such great jobs and we'd be better off just, you know, acknowledging that they don't exist anymore, we don't really need them, and that we should instead be trying to create jobs that that cannot be done by machines, that require skill and training and the human touch.
It's true that the future probably is one where people with more skill are going to have a lot easier time getting a job, and particularly technical skills. Shadow work jobs like pumping gas are often ones that the customer can learn immediately, in a minute or less. So those entry-level jobs are disappearing, and one has to wonder what's going to happen in the future. If an ATM removes the need for a teller, how does a teller, like my dad once was, work his way up to become the CEO of the bank? You've got to start somewhere. But it's also true that there are higher-level jobs that are being affected by shadow work, too. If you are a lawyer, a lot of legal forms can be downloaded online and filled out by the customer, the client at home, and perhaps brought for a lawyer to see them to kind of do some light lawyering. So sometimes even the higher skilled professions could be vulnerable.
Well, I mean, really what you're describing is all of these little jobs where, I mean, basically we're having some sort of interface with a machine to do this stuff. I mean, that's usually the way it happens. It's cutting out a certain level of human interaction. I mean, we dealt with strangers more in our life than we do now, I think.
Yes. I talk about the way in which shadow work silos people. They get stuck in their own little world for a moment with a robot or a kiosk instead of dealing with a human being. And then there is a great deal of it coming out of the internet and out of advancing technology, which makes it possible for people to do things like book their own travel, which they never could do 30 years ago because they didn't have the information available.
Yeah. Well, it raises also the question, if we're talking about new technology and how this all figures into the information economy. I don't even know if this fits into your concept of shadow work, but let's take Facebook, for example. I mean, every time we log onto Facebook, we are, in a sense, doing work for them. I mean, we are helping them build their algorithms. I mean, essentially, we're helping their advertising. Is that shadow work?
It absolutely is. It is shadow work when we contribute to any of these consumer-driven sites like Facebook or like Yelp, when we write consumer reviews. Facebook is something that is so gigantic that when they went public and sold stock for several billion dollars, some of the users said, hey, where's my cut? Because all the content on Facebook has been created by the users. That's all free work. It has been done for nothing. Now, the users certainly get something for their free work. They get the enjoyment of using Facebook. And Facebook will always encourage people to post more, to add more friends, to tell us more about your favorite videos and music and so on. Because the more information they have, the more they can sell. This is one of the adages of the information economy, is that if you are not paying for the product, you are the product. You are going to be what is being sold by Facebook to the advertiser because they have your attention, they have your contact information, and that is one of the most precious resources there is in this day and age.
So the question is that a fair trade? Facebook and other big tech companies get all kinds of information about us, and we get to use it, and we get to connect with people in ways that we wouldn't otherwise.
Well, that's right. In terms of whether it's fair or not, that really is each individual's call. How much time do you have? How much are you willing to invest in this? And do you mind if things get siphoned off and sold to advertisers that you thought you were just doing for your own entertainment?
Could we put this in some historical perspective? I mean, because really what you're talking about is you're saying we're just taking on lots more work that we didn't have probably even a few decades ago. But it raises the question of, are we really working harder? I mean, let's compare this to a couple hundred years ago. I mean, we no longer have to make our own food or clothes from scratch. We can have practically any product we want delivered to our door. And you can only imagine what it's going to be like in the future. So I guess the question is, I mean, is life really getting harder?
If you go back to colonial America, you'll see that almost everyone was doing housework all the time. You were gathering wood to make fire for heat. You were raising animals. You were planting crops. You were building the house itself. You were weaving wool to make your own clothing. It was subsistence work, and men, women, and children all spent almost all their time doing housework. Now, with the Industrial Revolution, that changed because people started going away from the home. They would leave the home and go to a factory or an office to make money and buy things that would enable their household to continue. And that's when housework in the modern sense really came about. So that was a change. And what has happened is technology has given us a great deal of power in creating more productivity. We're much more productive workers now. And you would think that maybe we could knock off at noon. We're so productive per hour.
Right. That's always the thing that amazes me. I mean, we have all of this new technology, all of this new automation. So why don't we work fewer hours? Instead, we seem to be working more hours.
About 1928, John Maynard Keynes wrote an essay in which he said that the future in the 21st century, people were going to be working very little and they would be taking long vacations, months of vacation time. And it hasn't worked out like that at all. What has happened is our standard of living has gone through the roof. We now produce and consume a huge amount more than we did in the 20s or 30s, not to mention the 19th century. We don't realize how much our standard of living has gone up and how much we are scrambling to pay our Visa bills and our MasterCards in order to buy all these new things that are available and that technology makes possible.
So help me figure out this equation. We produce a lot more. Maybe when we work harder, I don't know, but we have a much higher standard of living. I guess the question is it all worth it?
Well, it comes down to what you value. As we do have a higher standard of living in material sense. We consume more goods and services. What I think has happened, though, is that we are losing control of our time. We are working a great amount, probably more than ever. And when we talk about saving time, we don't pay attention to the quality of the time. That's a purely quantitative judgment. I saved time. But what about how that time felt? What about the quality of your time? Did you enjoy it? We are turning a lot of our leisure time into work by the means of shadow work and by the fact that there is in an internet economy, production and consumption are essentially available 24 hours a day. And I think that we should recalibrate a bit. We need to take a step back and recognize how we are spending that time and whether it's really the trade-off we want to make. Is this really what we would rather do? When we're doing that shadow work, when we're filling out a survey to tell our healthcare provider what we felt about our last visit to the office in great detail, is that really how we want to be spending those 5 minutes? Or would we rather be throwing a frisbee with our daughter out in the yard? I think we have to start noticing when we're being asked to do things for nothing and whether that's really the choice that we would like to make under these conditions.
Craig Lambert is a former writer and editor at Harvard Magazine, and he's the author of Shadow Work, The Unpaid, Unseen Jobs That Fill Your Day. Steve Paulson talked with him. And now it's time for A Dangerous Idea.
Pleasure, the inevitable byproduct of our civilization. Tragedy of your times, my young friends, is that you may get exactly what you want.
I'm Lars Svensson, professor of philosophy at the University of Bergen. My dangerous idea is that work isn't what is wearing us out these days, but our leisure time. In fact, we've never worked less than we do today. Most people are actually happy with their work, even though they believe that work in general is getting harder. But their own work isn't getting harder in their reports. And we sleep less than we used to do a century ago, 1 or 2 hours a day. But whatever we're spending that time on, it's not work. So really, what is wearing us out? What is making us burnt out? It's really our leisure time. The whole norms of work have invaded our spare time, turning it into a commodity that has to be spent as effectively as humanly possible. We've turned Benjamin Franklin's old saying that time is money into a norm for our leisure life. And many people, perhaps even most, experience that they are more guided by strict timelines, by various appointments to keep and so on, in their spare time than in their working time. And whatever one should call such a time, it's definitely not a free time. So what I would do is really to embrace laziness. The problem today is that we've forgotten proper laziness. And as the old proverb, all work and no play makes Jack a dull boy, which isn't as new as many people say. Many people think that it stems from Stanley Kubrick's The Shining, but it really goes back to James Howell's Proverbs from the 1640s. When you turn your entire life into work, you become a really dull boy. And one could say that what differentiates working time from leisure time these days is that you get paid for your leisure time, and you have to pay for working even harder in your leisure time. So start relaxing, be lazy, do absolutely nothing, and then perhaps this whole phenomenon of being burned out will burn out.
Philosopher Lars Svensson with his dangerous idea. You can hear more dangerous ideas on our website at ttbook.org. We're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, a white woman adopts a Nigerian boy with a hidden history of child abuse. Christy Watson's new novel is called Where Women Are Kings. It's on our minds. It's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. This week we've been thinking about Christy Watson's new novel, Where Women Are Kings. It's the story of a couple who adopt a 7-year-old Nigerian boy named Elijah. But what they don't know is that Elijah has a violent history and he's a victim of child abuse. They also don't know that Elijah believes he's possessed by a wizard. Here's how it begins.
I can feel the wizard crawling out and flying around the room faster and faster, then swooping down the stairs. My heart thumps like it too is trying to get out. I walk down the stairs as quietly as possible with a thumping heart. The kitchen is quiet. The wizard climbs back inside and fills me up until my stomach burns and twists. It picks up the dishcloth with my mind and makes the cloth dance in the air. It dances all over the kitchen and above the cooker. The wizard likes making people sick and angry and mad. It likes the smell of things on fire. The cooker has tiny buttons on the side that Sue uses to turn on the fire. I've seen her do it. The wizard is laughing and I am crying and crying. The wizard is squeezing. The fire puffs and a tiny corner of the cloth turns black. Then there is orange on yellow. I want to close my eyes and lie down and cry, but the wizard doesn't let me. It forces me to watch as the fire grows and grows. The heat fills a hole that was there.
Hmm. That's beautiful and sort of terrifying. Christy, tell me how this book began for you.
I think with everything that I write, it starts with a character. And I think Elijah came to me first, and I imagined this loving boy who was just so full of goodness and yet had had terrible things happen to him. And from him, I suppose, I imagined the characters around him, but it all started with Elijah for me, this small 7-year-old boy with eyes bigger than the moon and whose heart was full of love. but who'd obviously suffered such terrible things.
So this is the story of an adoption, a complicated adoption. And Elijah believes that he's a wizard, or that he has a wizard inside him. How's he come to this belief?
I think it was originally driven by the bishop of his local church, who recognized the vulnerability of Elijah's birth mother, Deborah. And so when
bad things... Who is Nigerian.
Who is Nigerian, living in London. And when bad things started happening in her life, she turned to the church and he saw the vulnerability in Deborah and actually used that in the way that he started to tell her that there was a wizard inside Elijah, and that was why bad things were happening. And in order for her to get rid of this wizard, she would have to give him money so that he could help her.
Now, this bishop and this church, this guy tells her that her small child has a wizard or an evil spirit or something and needs to be exorcised, which is how Elijah comes to suffer a fair amount of physical abuse, fairly horrific abuse. I know you're a pediatric nurse. Have you had situations like this, cared for children in similar situations?
Yeah, and actually it's not something that's exclusive to Nigeria. Obviously, I can't go into specific details because of confidentiality, but I've looked after children who've suffered all manner of abuse in all kinds of situations, but faith-based abuse is definitely on the increase. In terms of my research in what's happening in Nigeria, there's a charity called Stepping Stones that are very, very useful, and they actually work with churches and go to Nigeria and actually work with people to basically say that there is no such thing as wizards and witches living in children.
So tell me more about faith-based abuse. You said it's on the rise?
Well, I think it's maybe that we're more aware of it, but it's certainly something that we're talking about more openly. And it's like any kind of alien thing that's happening. I think initially people in the system in the UK were very, very terrified of being deemed racist. And so they would avoid topics like, you know, anything that was considered culturally normal, which it's not culturally normal. And what's happening now is that there's a very big drive in the police, the social services and in the NHS to say that child abuse is child abuse, and there is no such situation when it's acceptable for somebody to denounce a child as a witch or a wizard. It's just, it's abusive.
So does that happen a lot, that a child is denounced as a witch or a wizard?
I think in certain countries, yes, it does happen more than we discuss. But again, it's not a normal practice. And the vast majority of people in other countries, for example, Nigeria, would say this is outrageous and this is child abuse. So it's not a normal thing for anyone from any background, but it is something that we all need to be aware of and discuss openly and talk about, because obviously there are children at the centre of this that are suffering.
You're also a mother, and you're white, and your partner is Nigerian, I think.
My ex-partner is Nigerian.
Sorry about that.
That's okay. No problem.
Well, I was wondering, have your children, as mixed-race children, have they encountered much racism?
Yeah. And I was very shocked. And I think coming from growing up in a white family, I wasn't aware of the level of racism that existed. I just didn't appreciate how things are, and didn't understand my own privilege just from growing up as a white person in predominantly white country. And it was only when I became part of a mixed family that I really encountered racism for the first time. I mean, my daughter was, you know, shouted at when she was about 18 months old, and somebody shouted the N-word at her and started shouting racially abusive things at her in a park, a group of four men. And I was so shocked. And that's one incident of many, sadly, that still happen now in London. And London's a very multicultural, diverse city that's very inclusive. And that's one of the things I love about it. But certainly there's much more racism than ever I'd imagined. It's a scary and terrifying thing.
Now, I'm curious, we're talking about race. Has anybody ever asked or suggested that as a white woman, maybe you're not qualified to write an African family story?
Yeah, I mean, this story is about a mixed family, so I guess I am a mixed family. Mm. But my first book was written from the first-person point of view of a 12-year-old Nigerian girl, and I struggled myself, I think, most of all, with my right to write it. The people that have given me confidence in that sense are the Nigerian literary community. If people like Teju Cole and Lola Shoneyin and Helon Habila and people like that are saying that, you know, I've got every right to write this because it's a good story and you're telling the voice in an appropriate way, then I don't worry about my right to write anymore because they're the people I really feel I need to listen to.
Mm. There's something I wanted to ask you about. I read you're a pediatric nurse, I mentioned.
Yeah.
And you wrote something I read which I really liked. You said that you don't think of nursing as that unusual a day job for a writer, that the two, that there is some connection for you between nursing and writing. What do you mean?
Well, I think people are very interested in the fact that I still nurse. And for me, the reason I nurse is the same as the reason that I write. I'm looking for answers to questions, and I never find the answers. I just have more questions. But I suppose it's about the big things for me. I nurse to understand something of humanity, of life and death and love and loss and grief and the big things, and that's exactly why I write. So I'm exploring those questions in my day job in as much as I'm exploring them in writing. And I do think they complement each other. I certainly feel nursing has given me an insight into emotion that I would never have had, and I hope that transmits to the page when I write.
Christy Watson's new novel is called Where Women Are Kings. If you like what you heard this hour, subscribe to our podcast. Just look us up on iTunes, Stitcher, or any other podcasting app. And while you're there, leave us a review. That helps other people find the show. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Madison, Wisconsin, and the studios of Wisconsin Public Radio. Raymond Tungekar produced today's show. He had help from Doug Gordon, Craig Ely, and Charles Monroe Kane. Our theme music comes from Steve Mullen from Walk West Music. Kirill Owen is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. And I'm Anne Strainchamps. Thanks for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.